From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in July of 2011 with the launch of a small ice cream company called Eat Me. That's direct enough. The co-owner saw an opening in the market in several ways. They wanted to make ice cream from scratch. And before you say, well, lots of people say they make it from scratch, they might caution you not so fast on that. We'll talk about that. Caitlin Augustin and Amber Odner had this idea that ice cream could go the way of coffee, third wave coffee as it's called, or craft beer. More specialization, higher quality, more precision. Third wave ice cream? Maybe so. They grew slowly at first, but the last couple of years has seen significant growth, the kind that they wanted but didn't know if they would achieve, and that alone could make for an interesting small business success story conversation. But there is a recent twist that includes a strange question: why would coconut milk have to be pasteurized? Is coconut milk milk at all? Yeah, I know, kind of weird, but interesting. And I hope we get an answer to that and a lot more with the co-owners of Eat Me Ice Cream who are here for the hour. Caitlin Augustin, nice to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Evan. It's great to be here.
Amber Odner, nice to see you
Hello,
as well.
Oh, you too.
We were just talking before the hour began about this really technical paradigm you sent to small business owners, which was if you run out of money, you have to stop, and you just haven't run out of money yet.
That's right.
it's a very high bar. No, I joke because 5 years ago, as you know, when you launched and you celebrated 5 years in July, a lot of small businesses don't make it to 5 years.
That's correct.
And did you think, I mean, I guess, was it like, well, let's just see if what happens here. And if we run out of money, I guess we have to stop. We'll do other things. Is that kind of the approach at first?
Yeah, it definitely began as an experiment. And we just let it unfold summer by summer until it became an all-around business. Word of mouth really was our biggest boon.
And the community networks that we've created here. I would consider us a part of the craft local food movement and spurring sort of why people would want to be here, live here, and experience Rochester.
And unfortunately for you, if you thought, well, I guess we'll get to go back to doing other things, you've had to really concentrate on the business the last couple of years, haven't you? Almost setting a lot of other things aside because you've grown and had so much success. Is that also correct?
Yes, very much so. I've recently left Midtown Athletic Club to focus specifically on this.
Okay.
Yeah, and I've been full-time for a little over a year.
How do you like that?
Oh, I love it. I mean, it's the dream, right? If we can keep growing, that's the entrepreneurial dream.
Well, I think there's a lot of interesting things from the small business side that I'd like to hit this hour. So let's kind of just set the story first, though. How you know each other and what your work backgrounds were before you both went to school for ice cream creation, or no? Didn't major in ice cream?
No.
We did not major in ice cream.
Okay, so you mentioned you were at Midtown, but tell me a little bit about your background first.
Yeah, so I definitely come from a creative background. I went to SUNY Oneonta for fashion design and textile science. I then came back, it was kind of around 2008, and this is really when the local food movement was starting to explode. The market had crashed, and people were wondering, okay, what to next? We were kind of in disillusionment about what is the future, and is school really going to give you more things? So came back, took a few business classes at RIT, did massage therapy at MCC, utilizing my networks there, and got involved in the Rochester scene pretty heavily. Kind of that background.
Okay, and Amber, yours?
Yeah, and I studied painting and fine arts at Hampshire College in Western Mass, and then had lived out on the West Coast for a little while, and then came back here. Caitlin and I go way back.
So far back.
Yeah, so far back. Yeah. So old friends, and had just kept in touch and wanted to do something together. And when we both moved back here, started like looking around, asking questions, and dreaming about what this city needed. When there are these options to move to New York City or these bigger cities, and we're like, well, what about revitalizing this one and bringing, and what we have seen in Rochester over the past 5 years is a really cool little renaissance of local craft businesses, which has meant that young people stay and start businesses.
Yeah.
So we're part of that.
By the way, when it comes to your art degree in...
Mm-hmm. Painting.
Did you want to do that for a career?
Yeah, I'd always considered going back for a master's. Mm-hmm. But just had let this business unfold and opportunities unfold. And you can always go back to school. Even if I'm an old lady, I can still go back.
No, I ask about the art thing because we've had some really interesting conversations about just the challenge for artists to get paid for their work.
Oh, yeah.
You know, whether Rochester really is an arts town, or do we like to think we're an arts town? Do we really vote with our wallet for the art scene? So we could probably sidetrack on that for a while.
Oh, we could sidetrack.
But is that why you also, does that take you to the West Coast? Was that for trying to sort of make it in art at the time?
Well, actually, no, a variety of reasons. I did have a studio there and showed a few places mm-hmm. on the West Coast. But it was more as an intent just to take time off between school, create a body of work, and keep creating work outside of school before returning.
Okay. Well, ice cream is an interesting component of the craft world.
Yes.
And so you knew each other going way back. But what was it that put you in the mindset of, we could do this as a company, we could do this as a business?
Yeah, well, we had this real big desire to create something together out of our creative intuitions, and just wanting to, when we saw the lack of a local ice cream, especially non-dairy, something Amber had kind of experienced already happening on the West Coast, we really dove into it and attached to it. Also, the fact that ice cream is super infusible, and we have a beautiful growing season from that starts April to late November or October, November. So we wanted to really utilize that. And there was nowhere downtown that you could get a real local soft serve cone.
And also that ice cream is truly continually surprises me as being one of the most fabulous things you can put in your mouth. I mean, what an artisanal product. It requires this thing, all this machinery, and it has to be kept frozen. And so few people would refuse an ice cream cone. I mean, it's one of the most favorite foods. And for us, too, like we eat ice cream every day.
A favorite American pastime. So we've kind of just updated it using local and sustainable fair trade ingredients.
Okay. So when it comes to either the terms locally made or from scratch, you know, you talk to various people in your line of work, and those are interesting mm-hmm. terms because, you know, it's kind of like the term reserve in winemaking. Legally means, that means nothing. You know, you can put reserve on any label of wine you want in this country, and it means zilch. When it comes to from scratch, what does that really mean in ice cream?
Yeah, so from scratch means making your own base. So the base is the backbone of the ice cream. It's your cream, milk, sugar, maybe egg, and salt, basically. So everything other than the flavor. And that was part of our intrigue into the business as well, was that no one makes their own ice cream.
That's not what we hear, though.
Right. It's not what you hear. You see homemade everywhere because people will buy the pre-made base and add their own flavor. So, and there's a spectrum of quality in terms of how you can add your own flavor.
Yeah, that constitutes to them the homemade quality. So, but to us, they're still dumping, you know, blueberry can something in it and not utilizing the local blueberry flair.
And it would be like taking a craft beer and saying, oh, well, we just added the hops. You know, everything else was done. That in relation to like another craft product that most people are familiar with.
Or I guess, in your view of this definition, would it be like a winemaker bringing in juice from California and saying, well, we fermented it to, you know, we added the
right. Yeah, exactly. Like we bought the juice and then we just put it in the bottle or we added our own label on it.
Yeah, it's definitely a philosophy that can be debated for sure. The term of locale and locus, basically. Where are things coming from?
Does it matter, though? I mean, I know to you it clearly does. Why do you think it does matter?
Well, for food lovers and people that really want to support local business and a high-quality craft product, that's important to some people and not all people. We could also get into the conversation about, is it really good for our local economy and farmers? As I mentioned, so upstate is the biggest, you know, they make an ice cream base. So a lot of our milk system is based off of milk pools. So most of the farms you see out on driving through the country, those farms are contracted with upstate. The milk is gathered. It's all put together into one big vat. So small farms, big farms of all qualities are being put together. And that makes a lot of sense in some ways for farmers, especially with the kind of policy that they're working under. But it doesn't really fit into a craft food perspective of the demand now for truly local, high quality ingredients and foods.
And how do you then fit into that truly local, How do you do it in a way that's good for the farmers? You know, how do you set up a system where sort of it's kind of this mutually beneficial that is one of the ideals, I think, of the craft movement?
Right. That's a great question. I mean, that's our question, kind of posing back to New York State. And I think for the most part, there is an active movement happening. You can see the Craft New York Act that came through, and we're trying to put together something like that. But
that would relate to the dairy industry or to ice cream specifically.
You're trying to put together a Craft New York Act for
dairy. We're just kind of poking into that. What would that look like?
Does it require legislation? Does it require sort of different...
It does require legislation.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what do you think it does look like?
So, for example, part of the Craft Act, there's a farm brewery license that one can attain. Mm-hmm. So maybe something like that for a small producer of frozen desserts or dairy, where there's just a middle ground. Because as it stands now, if we were to go forward with processing our own ice cream base, we would essentially be a manufacturing plant for dairy. So the same rules that apply to us would apply to Perry's or very large scale producers. It's very expensive. It's a huge operation. It's a huge investment that a small producer, it's a huge chasm. That's why no one makes their own ice cream, essentially. I mean, it's a big hurdle.
Sometimes it takes a proselytizer for an industry. It was 40 years ago that the New York State Farm Winery Act passed, mm-hmm. and Walter Taylor went to the state legislature, and my uncle Roland Kidder, who was a state lawmaker at the time, recalls Walter Taylor standing up on the tables in the Capitol wearing a cowboy hat and boots and handing out grapevines to individual legislators and saying, grow your own grapes, you can do it, but we need a Farm Winery Act because it's all geared to the big guys. There's no protection. And Walter Taylor got what he wanted. And now, of course, Bully Hill, which was Walter Taylor's baby, is one of the bigger producers, but the bottom line is the Farm Winery Act was very, very important for that region. I mean, without it, I don't think you'd see anywhere near to the number of bonded wineries you have in the region. So it sounds like what you're looking for is 40 years later, you're saying in our industry, we might need a similar kind of either carve out or new rules, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, and updated, basically. Or something for frozen desserts, this title in Ag and Markets that falls under the dairy market of Ag and Market sector, just separate that out and pull it out, because you're seeing a lot of innovation in that area. So that's not really related to milk processing.
All right, so make sure our listeners understand a couple of things, though. I'd like to ask you what you think you're hearing, or at least if you're getting feedback from the from the legislature. But before we even get there, tell us again what's onerous on the small side. Make sure we understand what the limitations are, some of the shackles are, what the lack of this kind of legislation.
Okay. Yeah.
So, there are two kind of sides to this. There's milk production, which we aren't doing. We don't have, but it's related to ice cream. And there's what we are trying to do with the frozen dessert. So essentially, the biggest hurdle is that if you want to create your own ice cream base, as we've been doing, and sell it beyond your own kitchen and special orders. So we still are producing ice cream. We sell it right out of our kitchen. Anyone can place a special order, come pick it up. We also do farmers markets and private and public events. So we can do this under a 20C license. But as soon as you want to go through a middleman, you have to take this big jump. And the big jump mostly would be a pasteurization system. So
yeah, the double pasteurization standard, which is something that we wanted to talk about.
Right, because what we do now is we don't have the vat pasteurizer, but everything that we use is pasteurized, and they have to re-pasteurize it. So this is this kind of double standard.
Is that for consumer protection? I mean,
it is. Yep, and like, you know, milk code goes way back for obvious reasons, but you know, these pasteurization systems as they stand now, essentially you're signing up to become a manufacturing facility. So it's a big jump for a producer, because not only would we be making our own ice cream and marketing it, but we would be managing a manufacturing facility, which is, as I mentioned already, just a large commitment financially and otherwise.
Okay.
And there are a lot of rules involved in that too that have proved very difficult to navigate.
Right. And then also sort of these old terms that they've placed about what can and cannot be used in the ice cream base. Corrugated can products are allowed. Certain things after pasteurization, but pre-made syrups that are aseptic, but typically in the past, they've been filled with high fructose corn syrup and dyes. So that, again, is a hurdle for us, getting back to your question, because we've updated it. We've basically hacked that. I mean, we're looking for an updated version.
So when the state comes back and says, hey, look, we're just protecting consumers, you're saying we understand that and we want consumers to be protected, mm-hmm. but this is too onerous and some of this is unnecessary. Is that?
Well, yeah. We're also protecting consumers in that when we make strawberry ice cream, they're fresh strawberries. They're organic and they're from a farmer. It's not a canned, processed strawberry syrup full of stuff that we don't know the ramifications for health of that yet. We'll probably know within our lifetime, which is a different conversation. But we see this as protecting consumers. We're offering a super high quality product that reflects the bounty of upstate New York. And there just aren't updated codes for dealing with or encouraging the use of fresh local products.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also, what we wanted to make note is that there is also a bare minimum education on these processes. Handing out a license and the law associated with that license is one thing, but where is the actual resource? So far, we have had no resource and have had to do a lot of our own digging and networking to get answers. Meanwhile, we're still waiting from Cornell.
And we don't see this just about ice cream either. This is about the barriers for all small food producers in a system that encourages top-down production and that encourages, you know, it's very difficult and expensive to navigate the system. And that's why the majority of our foods are made by or held within a few corporations. I mean, this is part of the problem. Like, it's a barrier to entry for small producers, not just in ice cream, in any kind of food.
It's been a theme we've had on the show lately is the concentration of economic power in smaller number of hands and barriers to entry for those who might challenge that.
Right. And policy and legislation is what's going to help those producers to take share.
So, listeners, we're talking to the co-owners and the founders of Eat Me Ice Cream, who celebrated 5 years in business this past summer. It's Caitlin Augustine and Amber Odner. You guys are online where?
EatMeIceCream.com.
Easy to find. Now, on the subject of dealing with government and policy, which I do want to circle back and ask you, did you think you would have to be doing this 5 years ago when you launched? But on Twitter, one of our listeners wants to know, it says, Senators Funky and Robach are positioned in ag and economic development. Have they reached out to them about this?
I don't think so.
Well, yet. We did send out a few letters to some of our representatives, but not them specifically. So great advice.
Thank you so much.
And we will.
We have talked to the District Assembly over at Harry Bronson's office recently and have written the food department of Cornell, the head there, to just get some answers.
Okay. You know, this governor has spent a lot of time, Andrew Cuomo spent a lot of time in his economic development team promoting Finger Lakes wine, promoting yogurt, promoting beer.
Yogurt.
What's that?
Yogurt, huge. I mean, just look at what he did for New York.
So I guess where I'm going with this is this administration, the Cuomo administration, certainly wants to position itself as friendly to tourism, friendly to agriculture of all sizes, friendly to craft agriculture. And I'm wondering if you feel that that's true, given what you're trying to do in your position in the craft food world. In other words, do you think he hasn't earned that? Or do you think, look, this is what we're asking for is somewhat new and you're hoping that, you know, as time unfolds here, they'll see the need for it? What do you think?
Well, I personally think, yeah, it's somewhat new and we're here and we've proved that this is somewhat new. I mean, we're still one of the only ones who are doing this in this area. And I've definitely seen, I mean, people ask me, wow, you know, there's so many craft breweries now. And I'm like, did you miss the Craft Act? I mean, did you miss all of that? I mean, that's why, that's a part of the reason why there's been this explosion. And I think that's great. I mean, Taste of New York and Made in Upstate, things are going to become more about what products are coming out of each state as food policy and things change. So I think it's definitely he's making the right headway. And I've been reading this book called The Entrepreneurial State, which actually kind of debunks the myths behind private sector and the role of the state, and asking, it's kind of like a call to arms for the state to actually stand up and own how it does actually innovate and take huge risks where private sector is too shy to maybe take that risk. It's not like the state isn't perfect necessarily, but it definitely has a role in business and entrepreneurs and creating that. And it actually begs the question, like the practical question coming from it is the state's, why are some states more successful than others when you have private sector and the state working together? So it's very interesting.
And you're hinting that the answer may be that some states are willing to take more risks?
Yeah? Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. I would say, well, between New York and California, those are some big, hefty states making big moves.
Okay, so here's a total novice response to all of this, but tell me if I'm... So the sinister sort of the those who think that the who ascribe nefarious purposes to government policy would say, well, the reason that the small guys like Eat Me Ice Cream have more hurdles is because they have less money to give to campaigns, and you know, we've got corporate concentration of economic power, and yes, they're big givers. The others might say, look. There's these things called lawyers, and if they green light what you want, but somebody gets sick, then all of a sudden somebody gets sued, and there's no end to the litigious flow of what follows. I don't know if either of those are true. Is that in play in this discussion?
Well, I think it's interesting the first thing you said that we talked about this. I mean, we have had this discussion like, well, once we like, or this is very commonly said, I think, like, well, once we have money, once we're big enough, then we'll change the laws. But the truth is that once you're that big, you have different problems. As a business owner, you're always going to have problems that you have to face and overcome. So like, who is advocating for these very small businesses? And also that, you know, the system encourages you to co-pack and private label with other corporations, with bigger corporations, and to take your market share that way. So, but yeah, it's a great point. Like, we don't have the resources or the years to devote to pushing this through full time. I mean, it would be a very part-time endeavor.
Sure. And I would never say that government only responds to moneyed interests. I would never. I'm just posing the idea that some feel that way.
Sure.
Okay. On the subject of government not wanting to take risk because they're worried about pasteurization, they're worried about anything that might come into play to protect consumers. Mm-hmm. Is that maybe on their mind? Just this conversation is new to them that they are concerned about. Is that part of this?
Yeah, it is. It is part of it. And I think, well, our question generally, too, back to this sort of thing is, yeah, as you scale, you're seeing more of those outbreaks and issues at that larger level. I mean, is that the scrutiny is like really on those chains and with the Modernization Act, the Food
Modernization.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah, they're going to be focusing even into the restaurants and the chain restaurants specifically. That's their next move. And so, where is food going?
So it's an interesting point that just a bigger scale doesn't always mean safer.
Right.
Chipotle, but I mean, I like Chipotle. But I'm just saying. So anyway, I take the point you're making there. So. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Caitlin Augustin and Amber Odener from Eat Me Ice Cream. I ran into somebody earlier this week who was just on a tear about how I had to talk to you. And my guess is the story was a little overinflated. And I don't want to get either one of you in trouble as you seek to foster good relationships with the state and lawmakers. But this person was saying, you know, regulators have no idea. They were, you know, they wanted Eat Me Ice Cream to pasteurize coconut milk, which is not even milk, and
it's a fruit meat.
Yeah, right. And how could they do that? And that's totally misunderstanding the process, and that's going to cost them business. And I'm worried they're going to be off shelves. So I don't know what happened Thanksgiving week. I don't know if this is over dramatizing, but you want to share what happened there?
Yeah. So basically, as we've grown, we came to our attention that we have to make a decision about if we're going to go through the pasteurization system or we're up for a new type of license.
Okay.
So we aren't able to sell in grocery stores anymore until we have followed through with this licensing, which is in what we're in the midst of, which has been this arduous process we've described.
Yeah, almost a year or over a year.
Okay.
And yeah, that's a great question. Is this dairy-free? Because dairy-free is getting, it's hugely popular.
Let me just jump in and say, if you missed it earlier, Eat Me Ice Cream does both dairy-based and non-dairy ice cream.
Right.
And your non-dairy uses?
Coconut milk.
Okay.
Yeah, we use an organic coconut milk, and it's awesome.
But is that milk?
That's a great question.
It's in a gray area. I mean, we just had a response recently that said, I don't handle non-milks and I'm not, you know, not sure what to do with this. And so we're falling into this gray area.
But they're still pushing it through the same department that handles milk and frozen desserts.
The pasteurization rules and everything else. So if you called it coconut juice, would they ask you to pasteurize it?
Well, isn't that a great question?
That's a great question.
I mean, we're calling
it non-dairy. The term is non-dairy.
You put the word dairy, even if a non is in front of it. You know, it's like a neon sign that we should still pasteurize. I find that distinction interesting because if I were a small business owner, if I were in your shoes, I may say, look, we're going to pasteurize our milk-based ice cream, but what are you going to pull our products off the shelves if our coconut juice doesn't go through the same process as cow's milk? That seems strange.
Well, right, and that's the technicality, really. It's like we probably could have just left that non-dairy milk since you have no rules or it's a gray area for it. So we technically didn't have to pull it if we really got into the logistics of that.
Okay.
But for legal matters.
Are people still going to find your products, I guess? After this conversation, I thought, oh, my.
No, they have to come to our kitchen. Well, and that's the thing. We can still do what we do in this very small way, which is an interesting question, too, because I ask, like, why? Where is the logical break between letting us do whatever we want and then say, no, now you are under this department, when we're very small? We're a regional city brand, essentially.
Okay.
So where's the line for wholesale? Like, where does that break come? And is it based on scale or is it just arbitrary?
Yeah, is it based on gallons? Is it based on scale? What about the online store?
And that's what the Farm Brewery Act does, too. It's like if you're in a certain number of gallons of beer per year, you get to apply. You are qualified for this smaller license.
Okay. So you're seeing some of the headaches that they hope are temporary, though did you suspect more than a year ago when this started coming up that this would not be still a thing more than a year later?
Well, honestly, I mean, it should happen very fast. I don't understand where the information is. There seems to be some confusion
out there. Did you just say that something with government should happen very fast?
I know, right?
Well, I guess I'm still mystified at what Cornell's doing.
Okay. Well, what's Cornell's role?
So basically, according to, well, it's not even actually in the license, the Article 4A, but there's one potential for us to be able to do what we still do, and that's writing a process authority. So Cornell is the government's or the state's kind of laboratory, the food science department, and so they work together to create this license that we then follow, and then the state comes in and checks to make sure that we're doing what we're doing. So we're basically going through and making a make process for every single unique flavor, and that's their role, which we've been waiting on.
Well, that includes the non-dairy too.
However, there hasn't been any clear. I've asked, you know, for an agreement. How does Cornell work with companies? Where's the fee structure? Because allegedly now that there's more added fees for time put into this process. And then who owns the make processes? Do we own it? Because it's our formula. And then if we wanted a lawyer to represent us with Cornell and the state, how do we go about that? And also, are you going to sign our non-disclosure agreements that protect us for handing over our formulas?
Okay.
And all of this as well has just mostly, I mean, we're capable of getting through anything. We're a very resilient company. We're very resilient people. But really, it's opened our eyes to again, these barriers that obviously small businesses don't navigate the system, and they're not used to small businesses asking questions. They're used to this other system where people can just, I'm not sure. It just is, it's like, it has been just kind of very obscure.
Yeah, it's very, that's why I say that there's a parallel here to the Craft Act and sort of what the brewers and distillers and the liquor license and all of this stuff have gone through is because in the Buffalo Law Journal, they highlighted kind of this going, the push going forward. And they said, because it's such a heavily regulated industry, she said many clients have questions about the industry rules and where are the levels, where are the breaks, where is the information, where is the guidance? So getting back to your question.
Well, before we take our early break of the hour, how big have you become now? What did you start? You know, what was the first 6 months? How much were you producing? And then what's the state now?
Well, we started making about 20 ice cream sandwiches of three different flavors, two dairy and one non-dairy. They kept selling out at the farmer's market. So that's 60 ice cream sandwiches.
So in 2011,
thousands of ice cream sandwiches. I mean, our cookie lady is...
Oh, she's amazing.
You know, amazing.
Yeah, I think we did 40,000 sandwiches this year.
40,000 sandwiches.
Mm-hmm. Plus, we do pints, quarts, gallons for restaurants, 3-gallon tubs.
Okay, so compared to...
Special orders.
Compared to end thousands. Of 2012, you will end 2016 how much bigger?
Oh. four times as big?
Yeah, four times.
I guess in revenue, or five times as big. Oh, probably more.
Yeah, just about.
We have to get our charts together.
Okay. It's been a lot of growth.
Yeah.
And starting obviously very small.
Right.
But a lot of growth for you. And before we get that break then, remind our listeners where they can find you.
Yeah. So follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and eatmeicecream.com. And you can find us right now.
At the Hungerford.
Yep. At our Hungerford, our production kitchen.
You can taste there?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you can.
We have sweet pine ice cream right now.
What?
Sweet pine ice cream. It's a fabulous, fabulous winter flavor.
Mm-hmm. Sweet pine. Is it like spearminty?
It's like sprucey.
Sprucey.
Yeah. It's like we use fresh pine.
All right. In our second half hour, I want to get into more of the creation process. But I should also make sure that I ask you one other question, because some are listening to this. We had... some listeners who said, you know, we loved the summer of food conversations. You haven't talked food in a while. And I love talking food. But, you know, puts you guys in the spotlight. If you get what you want here, if there's sort of a version of the craft brewery or the farm brewery act, the farm winery act for your industry, will there be others? Will there be more competitors? Will it open the door to other growth, even if it's more competition?
Oh, we hope so.
Yeah,
that would be awesome. We welcome it just like craft brewers work together.
Yeah, we admire craft brewers. They're such an amazing group of people working together, brewing together, tasting all the stuff. I mean, I hope there's more craft ice cream creameries out there. We can do so many cool things. It's amazing.
And different milks from different farms taste different when they're not hyper ultra pasteurized.
Oh,
when
you it's have so beautiful.
It's fabulous. I mean, it's like
duck eggs. I mean, there's different eggs that you can use. We could do Hudson Valley inspired ice cream. I mean, geez.
There is a small, I guess it's ice cream. Yeah, producer on 54 between Penyon and Seneca Lake that does duck eggs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
yeah.
And I'm not remembering their names, but a couple times this summer.
Duck egg something.
Yeah, they make creamery.
And the ducks are right behind. They're just like hanging out. I'm like, hey, guys.
Yeah.
Really beautiful stuff. So, mm-hmm. But the bottom line is you think that we're sort of on the cusp of at least allowing for more of the marketplace to grow here.
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're so super encouraging of New York in general. I mean, the bounty that's here. And I think it's a great market. There's a great marketplace for us to compete with.
Well, yeah, and imagine seeing more diversity on the milk shelf. It's not just Upstate and Wegmans and Horizon Organic. It's like all these different farms that come onto the shelf. And there are just so many barriers that's we're never going to see that unless the legislation changes.
It's also interesting, the old-fashioned glass bottle thing is going to come back in a big way. And those were one of the main targets for bacteria in the past, but it's coming. It's going to come big. The milkman's coming back.
Really?
And the non-milkman. Yeah. Or the milk ladies.
Milk ladies.
All right, let's get that only break of the hour. We'll come back with the co-owners of Eat Me Ice Cream, Caitlin Augustin and Amber Odner, telling a small business story that is it's a story of growth, but also hitting a bit of this little hinge point on where they and their industry go next year. Interesting stuff, and we continue after this break on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the Next Connections, first hour, a local criminal justice professor tells his personal story, the violence he suffered, and how it moved him to look at criminal justice from a different perspective. Then in our second hour, Rochester Mayor Lovely Warren joins us talking about red light cameras. They're going away. She'll discuss why that decision was made, what the research tells us. Talk with you Thursday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Some of your friends in different industries in the sort of the small business food industry are jumping on Twitter, and it's interesting how many people in, from food trucks to craft beer to wineries to there's a lot of solidarity mm-hmm. for the craft food movement. So I always find that interesting. When we talked about your ice cream creation process, you mentioned Sweet Pine.
Yes.
What else is on? What's the most unusual run right now?
We also do a hickory bark and black walnut ice cream, which features a farmer that you'll see at the public market named Alexander. That is a truly, it's just a phenomenal Western New York winter flavor. We also do a taco ice cream every year in the fall.
What?
A taco.
It's a scoop of avocado cilantro, a black bean, a pinto bean, and then like a salsa tomato, all on a frito taco waffle shell.
Okay, see, this goes back to whose line is it anyway? They had this game that they did. They had this game they did called World's Worst Step. And they had world's worst ice cream flavors, and Ipecac was the worst ice cream flavor. That's what that old drink that makes you throw up if you're sick.
Oh, sure.
That would not be a good ice cream flavor.
No.
But Ryan Stiles said, have you tried the pork? And pork ice cream doesn't sound good, but oddly, you're making this taco ice cream sound pretty good.
It's delicious. It's savory sweet. It's the intersection of, and ice cream is the perfect vessel. No one ever, we always say, when it's too funky for one's taste, try it, and if you don't like it, we will give you your money back. And no one's ever asked for a refund.
Okay, all right.
There was, like, surprise and, like, wow, like, their eyes open up, and they're like, this is, like, awesome, or I'm so surprised, or I would never eat this again, but I'm so glad I tried it.
Yeah, flavor and taste it drives ice cream sales in general by over 70%. And I think only recently people have really become attuned to going back to the wine and brews and food in general, rediscovering their taste and what that is and what it can do. And it's an experience. And we're more about the taste experience and tongue revelations rather than ice cream.
Right. You won't come to us for ice cream sundae. You come to us for, a mouth revelation, a tongue like
sparkler.
Yes.
Okay. But I'm also curious to know, in the ice cream industry, is there pressure not just to do peanut butter cup sundae ice cream? You know, like the stuff that's very popular, but pretty standard.
Mm-hmm. Well, we boycotted pumpkin spice this year because
that's so good to hear. And you know what? I'm going to get into so much trouble because, you know what? I'm not going to hate pumpkin spice.
But you can.
It would be different if we called it squash spice because pumpkin is just squash.
Yeah.
And that wouldn't be as sexy. But right. there are some people who love pumpkin spice, and there are some, like Kai Rizdahl from Marketplace hates pumpkin spice. He's unapologetic. And I'm sort of in the church of Kai on this one. Mm-hmm. But so you boycotted pumpkin spice because there's just too much of it on the market?
Yeah, there's just too much
and
of it.
And it's too boring.
And peanut and butter cup, it kind of falls in that same line.
So we do chocolate vanilla, but we do it our own way. Like we use organic, amazing vanilla beans from Singing Dog. We use organic, equal, fair trade cocoa powder. We even have this amazing dye, natural dye sprinkle from India Tree.
Yeah.
So we're doing it differently.
From India Tree?
Yeah, it's a company in Seattle. So
it's all natural dyed rainbow sprinkles. So, and it also doesn't give you that chalky taste in your mouth.
Or a waxy taste. It's just a true, beautiful sprinkle.
And to, I imagine you had to do some variation of chocolate and vanilla. You can't be an ice cream company and not do that.
We have an ice cream sandwich called the Hug Up. It's a Nicaraguan dance where they get really, really, really close and kind of do the slow grind. And to us, that's a chocolate vanilla twist with rainbow sprinkles on a chocolate vanilla cookie. That was for all of the people who wanted the chocolate vanilla. So we definitely cater to regular flavors.
We did try not to. But the market here demanded something
more standard.
Simple.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned that in 2007, 2008, your eyes are open to the growing local food movement. The only James Beard-nominated chef in our region's history is Art Rogers from Lento. They opened in 2007, and he was very committed to that, but did tell us in a conversation on this program that he relented and said, okay, I'll put a burger on there.
Yeah.
Guess I have to. Mm-hmm. You know, we'll also do head cheese and things like that, but I'll have a burger. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the ice cream world's chocolate and vanilla. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you try to do it really, really well and really compelling, but you have to please the masses.
Right.
Okay. Who's the flavor creator?
Well, we both are to a certain extent.
Yeah. We recently came back from this accelerator with the nicknames Flavor and Taste or Taste and Flavor. So so we're kind of adopting those roles a little bit more.
By the way, I'm told it's Spotted Duck Creamery down at 54.
Oh, yes.
Thank you for that. That's certainly very helpful. And I'm before I grab a phone call and work in a different direction here, what's the worst idea you've ever had for an ice cream flavor?
Ooh. Probably beet goat cheese.
Yeah, that wasn't great.
We don't really like beets. I mean, we love beets, but we added way too many beets. So it was very hard. That was a long time ago, though. That's probably our first year. Other than that,
we had a request for Brussels sprout ice cream, and I don't know.
That was the one that we rejected.
Okay. That's from our best friend, actually, who's in New York City, and I don't know if we're going to make it.
There's certain lines I don't know if you can cross.
Yeah, it sounds...
Question from a listener off air. Well, a couple. First of all, a listener just said it's hard to understand the name of the company. Eat Me Ice Cream. Eat Me. That's the name of that.
That's the name.
Eat Me.
That's it.
Yeah.
It's eatmeicecream.com.
Yeah.
But I'm saying it quickly, so it might sound, but it's Eat, E-A-T.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Eat Me.
Ice cream. That's it. And another listener just wanted to know where the milk that you do use, where does it come from and what's in the milk? Tell us about the milk.
Okay. So for the majority of our history, we used milk from First Light Creamery, through First Light Creamery. So that's a Jersey cow farm out towards East Bethany. And they sell a very limited amount of the milk, but it is probably the best milk we've tasted in this area. And we've also used milk from, in the past, from Hillcrest Dairy in Moravia. And that's the closest organic cream that you can find, that we have found, in Western New York. And then after that, you have to go out to Hudson Valley, and you'll find a few options. Yep.
Okay. And, you know, we've been talking about what craft means. We've talked about that in coffee and beer and wine. And craft is an interesting word because the bigger you get, and big is, you know, growth is good for business. You guys are still growing. You'd like to grow more. But the question becomes, you know, how much can you grow and still be craft? And before the program began, you know, you sort of lit up and had an interesting answer to that. How would you answer that? When would you not be craft, or can you still be craft and see the growth that you want?
Yeah, right. So it's a great question, and one that, yeah, there maybe isn't really a strong, a hard definition of like when craft becomes a big corporation. So, you know, for us, it would be going through, once you have this investment in your manufacturing facility, it's a business question. What is your return? How much do you need to make to pay that off or to survive as a business? And really, once you have all this equipment, you want to be really producing and churning it out. And also you have to be able to keep up with this new scale. So if you're selling at Wegmans or Whole Foods, it's, you know, you have to be able to supply them and meet that demand. So it's a hurdle we haven't crossed yet, obviously. So I don't really know how to answer that question. All I see though is a system where it's an economy of scale and there's a lot of incentive to grow and get big. And there's a few incentives to really stay small. I'm sure there's a sweet spot in there, which I don't know. But, yeah, I mean, even for us with ingredients, the more you can buy, the better price you get.
Well, what's a best-case scenario for the growth of Eat Me Ice Cream, then? Have you talked about that? I mean, do you secretly have an idea that, you know, in a certain amount of growth and you sell the company, mm-hmm. a certain amount of growth and you cap it, you're happy at a certain point. I mean, have you talked about that?
Yeah. Post this accelerator program, we've most recently been diving into it and assigning it kind of a timeline. So we're still in the process of our ultimate vision, but we definitely want to be a beacon for taste and we would like to support Rochester in every way possible.
Okay.
But we definitely want to grow. I mean, a true dream is to create great jobs for other people. I think that's like a huge motivation for both of us, to create a cool company where it's not just about you and what you make, it's about the whole culture.
And also just generally taking yourself to the full potential. So what is the full potential? Still a question, but we definitely want to take ourselves to the fullest potential possible.
Richard emails the program to say, I believe the state of New York now requires apple cider to be pasteurized, mm-hmm. so calling coconut milk coconut juice might not help you.
Thank so, you, Richard.
It's a good point.
Yeah, even cold-pressed fresh juice has to be pasteurized.
Ken wants to know about, he says you got to ask him about Sazerac ice cream.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
That's coming.
Sazerac. That's coming.
That's an interesting legislation piece, actually, because Mercer's Dairy, a couple hours away, was able to write Mercer's Law, which is the ability to include and have at least 5% alcohol in every ice cream pint. He's doing his wine ice creams there that have gotten him a lot of press. But that is certainly part of the Craft Act. I mean, wine ice cream or beer or Sazerac ice cream, amazing. And we can do that with what we're doing. We can make it happen.
Well, and also back to craft, too, in a certain sense. I encourage people to shop a different way. So not just through your Stop and Shop at one store, like not just doing everything at Wegmans, but spreading it out and stopping in at small producers, like a farmer's market. I mean, then we'll see craft being able to thrive in a new way. As it is now, we've done farmer's markets for a long time. We see that as capping growth. Like, we've outgrown that model, which mm-hmm. is why we started to branch out. And there was more desire to have our products other places. So back to the craft question, I mean, if people are more encouraged to come to farmers markets and support small producers outside of a grocery store, then we'll see a very different system. But people are busy. They have to make that extra stop and really care and believe in it.
Yeah, and kind of the question of craft goes to the modern day. I mean, when you can get a food meal package delivered to you by Amazon Prime in one day, and then there's a food app, a restaurant app that helps eliminate food waste at restaurants, like, what is the question of craft? Like, what is the question of food policy and food regulation when we're in the modern day?
A question on regulation comes from Andrew in Irondequoit, who wants to weigh in. Go ahead, Andrew.
Hello, ladies. Sounds like you have a great product.
Thanks.
Thanks, yeah.
Although, I mean, Brussels sprout ice cream, really? No, I don't think you should do
that. Yeah, that was one of them we said no to.
Lots of agreement there.
Yeah. My question is about, like, where do you get your milk from?
Right. So we just answered that question. We have from two local sources. First Light Creamery in East Bethany, and also Hillcrest Dairy in Moravia, New York. Uh-huh.
We've also worked with a variety of people in upstate New York trying to source awesome, great milk. We have also worked with Pittsford Dairy in the past, specializing our building our custom mixed base.
What do those guys, I mean, because people are calling, I don't know why, but people are calling for more regulation on the farm, like unionize the workers and bring OSHA into the farms mm-hmm. and all that kind of stuff. How do you guys feel about that kind of stuff?
Well, I mean, dairy processing is really very different from what we're doing, and we don't know necessarily all of the different, we just know a brief amount of information regarding that. Milk ordinance is definitely at the federal level. So in general, we're seeing, like, with the Food Modernization Act, sorry, I can't say that word, that we're seeing that come through recently. So they're definitely targeting food safety. Food safety is a huge thing, but our question is, I mean, at what scale is that appropriate? So,
Andrew, thank you. A couple more questions from listeners. Well, Danielle says, I know how hard they work. I've often seen them cycling home after the Brighton Market. Love your vegan ice cream. So thank you, Danielle, for that. Tom just wants to know if these issues with regulations and concerns about growth, are they different in other states? And I think, in other words, if you wanted to set up this kind of operation in other states, is it easier?
It could be. We don't know all of the different rules mm-hmm. and each state, they're definitely different. However, again, milk is regulated at the federal level, so it's kind of a World War II thing to move milk faster. There's a huge history on it. It's very interesting. But that's also a possibility. We could set up somewhere else and sell into New York.
Okay. We're most inspired to probably go back to Nicaragua and start an ice cream business there.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we've got about a minute left, and this is always a trite question, but I think for anybody who's listening who's ever thought about, I'd love to start my own business, or I'm curious. So it's trite, but I think it's still valuable. I'm just under a minute left here. What is the, if you go back 5 years and talk to yourselves and warn yourselves about being a small business owner that you did not know when you launched in July of 2011, it would be what?
Oh. What would it be?
Amber's trying to figure out what to say without saying too much. And now you've got 30 seconds left. So what's the answer?
Okay. I would probably just tell myself to, well, actually, I would just say be fearless, ask questions, and push, and do whatever you can. Just be fearlessly and move fast. Don't let anything hold you back. And that's the biggest deterrent for people. They say, oh, I wish I was doing that. It's like, well, you can wish and wish, then you can just do it. And that's what we've done. And it's hard. And you're sacrificing a lot of the luxuries that come with a regular job. Although you don't see them as luxuries when you have one.
Status quo is easier.
Yes.
Change is hard.
Change is hard, but we're in it and we love it.
Is it worth it?
Totally worth it.
Yeah.
I mean, we're here to make a ruckus.
Yeah.
And poke and...
taste revelations, ask questions, and be a part of the movement.
EatMeIceCream.com. Really interesting to hear all the hurdles you face, but who knows what might be coming out of this. Thank you for coming in and sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for
having
us.
Really appreciate it.
And Amber and Caitlin from Eat Me Ice Cream, Rob Braden, the engineer of this broadcast, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on this program, Friday, live at the Little Theater. We've never done a live broadcast with a live audience. It's free. We're kind of capping our teacher diversity series that's going to airing all week. Would love to see you on Friday there. Have a great afternoon.